The fictional narrative and characters are inspired by authentic historical events and figures. All included artworks in the storytelling are the curatorial team's interpretation. 1906, The Journey Begins. Quote from Celebrated Travels and Travellers by Jules Verne, 1881. Singapore was simply one large warehouse to which Madras sent cotton cloth, Calcutta, opium, Sumatra, pepper, Java, arak and spices, Manila, sugar and arak, all forthwith dispatched to Europe, China, Siam, etc. Of public buildings, there appeared to be none. There were no stores, no careening wharves, no building yards, no barracks, and the visitors noticed but one small church for native converts. I was born in 1906. I only came to realize later that it was a special year. My parents are Teochew, coming from the Chaoshan region in China. Our home in Singapore was in Kampong Melaka, near Clarke Quay, known colloquially in Teochew dialect as Cha Chung Tao, meaning harbour for ships carrying firewood. Running across bridges and jumping into water are some of my earliest memories. The Kampong was always bustling with energy and noise. Back then, river transportation was dominated by the Teochew community. Most of the tuakos were owned by Teochews. Our tuakos were all painted red, distinct from the more colourful Hokkien tuakos with red, green and white mixed boat heads. But no matter tongkangs, tuakos, praus or junks, they all transported firewood and sacks of goods. Those sacks contained nutmeg, gambia, coffee, pepper, and pineapples, my father explained. However, they weren't meant for us. They were meant for the West. I grew up watching lighters transfer goods to tuakos and witnessed the meticulous stacking and covering of goods by coolies when rain threatened. I attended a Teochew school named Tuan Mong School on 52 Hill Street. In 1913, it moved to an old Chinese building at River Valley Road. Today, that building is known as the River House. Behind the school was a godown that stored gambia, owned by a gambia Kang Chu from Johor by the name of Tan Lok Suan. Clarke Quay was dotted with godowns, recognizable by their oversized jack roofs, which helped dissipate heat. Hu Ka Khi Wampo's Ice House also stood in Clarke Quay. But my favorite building was Pineapple King Tan Tai's Canneries, and the delightful aroma of pineapples always made me hungry. My father worked as a clerk for the legendary businessman Mr. Wampo. It was through him that my father learned English, and he subsequently taught me before I went to St. Joseph's Institute. 1922, Ridley and bird watching. When I was 14, I had to start working. Thanks to my father's connections with Mr. Wampo, I secured a minor position at Botanic Gardens instead of working on the river. As a leading member of the Agri-Horticultural Society, he allocated a section of land from his Tanglin plantation for the Botanic Gardens. Mr. Wampo had a splendid garden called Nam Sang Faun on Serangoon Road. I recall visiting this garden with my father, marveling at the rockeries, aquariums, bonsai, and well-trimmed topiaries. Mr. Wang Po generously opened his garden to the public during Chinese New Year for gatherings. In the 1920s, the botanic garden appeared rather primitive to my untrained eye. Green lawns, green trees, too much green, with European-style houses sporadically dotting the landscape. But it was here that I was taught things like how strong sunlight would destroy chlorophyll. That's one of the reasons the leaf turns yellow, or what they called the chlorotic appearance of the imported rare plants. I also heard some great stories. When Henry Merton was the superintendent, the garden had a zoo, which included rhinos, kangaroos, and monkeys. When I joined the Botanic Gardens, it was under the direction of Isaac Henry Burkill, who succeeded Henry Nicholas Ridley, more famously known as Matt Ridley. Director Burkill, the second director, contributed greatly to the economy, botany, and steered the garden to become an independent scientific research institution. Since I knew English, I was sent to be Director Burkill's pitch boy and often followed him around. The economic garden was one of our frequent destinations. Set up during Merton's time, it focused on cultivating plants and seeds for commercial plantations. This effort extended beyond rubber to crops like sago, sugarcane, and indigo. Even though expanding the economic garden was Henry Merton's primary aim, the Burmese banyan tree was still one of his favorites in the garden. See, the banyan tree was already sizable even back in 1877. A researcher showed me an old photo of it. While reading the aged documents of Ridley, I read and heard a lot about him and his fascination with rubber. The inaugural patch of para rubber trees was planted in 1876, a mere 22 specimens from London's Kew Gardens. Ridley pioneered a breakthrough V-shaped cut in the bark that could be reopened periodically to extract latex while preserving the tree's life, which is much more sustainable than the old harvest-then-die method. And there are more tricks. I read that tapping before dawn yielded more latex than tapping in the afternoon. Recognized as the father of the rubber industry, Ridley relentlessly pushed for rubber's adoption, encouraging plantation owners to cultivate it. The invention of pneumatic tire by John Boyd Dunlop in 1888 sparked a global rubber demand and proved that Ridley wasn't so mad. Though the demand didn't start until 1906, interestingly, that's the year I was born. Maybe I was destined to work at the Botanic Gardens. By 1917, the Botanic Gardens provided and sold 7 million rubber seeds from the economic garden, just as the rubber boom was in full swing. Ridley also loved birds. I found a pamphlet with his Birds in the Botanic Gardens Singapore included. His words paint a vivid and playful picture and show how his great passion for our feathered friends. I had one small black and white hornbill in captivity for some time, which became very tame and was wonderfully clever in catching bits of bread thrown at it. It used to be very quick at catching sparrows if they imprudently flew through its cage. When caught, it would crush them with its powerful beak and, throwing them up in the air, catch and swallow them. Woodpeckers or burung gelatu of the Malays are not uncommon, though less so in localities where there is much dead timber left standing. The absence of crows from Singapore seems very strange, especially to visitors from India and Ceylon, where these birds are so much in evidence. The common crow I have not seen south of Pekan, where it is common. By 1925, the Economic Garden closed down to make space for Raffles College. Ridley's small article sparked my interest in birds, and I started looking for them everywhere. 1930, how the gardens began. Lorries had largely replaced bullock carts as the primary means of transporting goods on roads. On the river, I discovered that the goods had changed. Bales of rubber, pineapples, sacks of coffee, and rice on twackles. My knowledge from working in the garden helped me discern their origins and destinations. I know pineapples are grown as an intercrop alongside slow-growing rubber trees. Even though the soil in Singapore was poor, it somehow produced the best-tasting canned pineapples. I also noticed a decline in the number of goods transported on regional vessels. This was attributed to the effects of the economic depression, a topic I overheard being discussed at the gardens. There were rubber sheets bundled into bales weighing as much as 100 kilograms that required careful stacking within the twackles to ensure stability and even weight distribution. Due to the cumbersome nature of baled rubber, handling it posed a challenge. I recall witnessing a coolie struggle to grip those unwieldy bundles properly. Intrigued by working with the British at the Botanic Gardens, I explored stories from their angle and how they affected our local lives. I saw many lighter men enjoy an evening drink of toddy or listen to traditional storytellers after a long day of labour at Coleman Bridge, named after its designer, Irish George D. Coleman. It was disheartening for Mr. Coleman to discover that the bridge named after him suffered from poor construction. Eventually, the flimsy bridge was replaced by an iron bridge which stands over my lifetime. Coleman's first Singapore project was actually very close by, at Fort Canning. While Raffles and his wife Sophie travelled to Bencoolen in Sumatra, Coleman designed Raffles House in preparation for Raffles' use. Raffles was quite impressed by it. We have lately built a small bungalow on Singapore Hill, where though the height is inconsiderable, we find great difference in climate. Nothing can be more interesting and beautiful than the view from this spot. The tombs of the Malay kings are close at hand, and I have settled that if it is my fate to die here, I shall take my place amongst them. This will, at any rate, be better than leaving my bones at Bencoolen. If it pleases God, we still live in the hope of embarking for Europe towards the end of the year. Stanford Raffles, January 21, 1823. However, I never saw the house since it was demolished 40 years before I was born. I also learned that this was the first site of Singapore's Botanic Gardens. Around 1822, Danish Nathaniel Wallich proposed to Raffles to set up a garden for botanic and experimental cultivation at Fort Canning. The first site was established on the lower slopes of Government Hill, starting with 125 nutmeg trees, 1,000 nutmeg seeds, and 450 clove trees, which laid the foundation for Singapore's spice industry. I am laying out a botanic and experimental garden And it would delight you to see how rapidly the whole country is coming under cultivation. My residence here has naturally given much confidence, and the extent of the speculations entered into by the Chinese quite astonished me. Stamford Raffles, January 21, 1823. Coleman's work spanned both Boat Quay and Raffles Place, the location of Singapore's inaugural land and reclamation initiative. The region previously occupied by these hills was transformed into Commercial Square and eventually evolved into Raffles Place. Most folks don't realize in 1819, Raffles' longest stay in Singapore was just 31 days. Fast forward to 1824, he left with a cart of treasure and never came back. In contrast, Coleman left and returned, leaving a long legacy of outstanding design and local craftsmanship that developed under his influence even after he died in 1844. Coleman was buried at Fort Canning's Old Christian Cemetery, which he designed. I visited his grave once. It is located at the higher end of the slope side of the cemetery compound. Sacred to the memory of George Domgall Coleman Esquire of Drogheda, Ireland, who was for many years the superintendent of public works in this settlement, the important duties of which department he was acknowledged to have discharged with zeal and ability, while the many public improvements which he originated and carried into effect will long attest the value of his services. As for myself, I met a young lady who asked for directions in the gardens. She was impressed by my knowledge of birds and trees. We started dating, and a year later, we were married in a small ceremony. Mr. Wampole helped with the expenses. Little did we know that the years ahead would be some of the most difficult for the country. 1939, the war years. Around 1932, I was moved to work as a foreman with the new assistant director, Dr. Edward John Henry Corner, under director Eric Holtham. Corner started, but was mostly a cheerful person. When he came to Singapore, he recuperated in hospital for a while due to contracting whooping cough. He took the opportunity to learn Malay while he recovered. Corner was a very tall man who always drove around in his two-seat rugby car. His specialty was fungi, but he was a man of many talents. Outside the Botanic Gardens, Ridley's influence was evident. By 1935, almost 40% of Singapore's land area was covered by rubber plantations, including NTU campus, where you stand now. At the same time, the invention of the chainsaw set off a wave of logging destruction. It was because of this ruthless and noisy new tool, which could cut down a tree in minutes, that convinced botanists to prevent the perpetual loss of Singapore's remaining forests. It threatened ancient trees and the enclosed ecosystems they nurtured. Corner and Holtham passionately embarked on extensive written appeals, advocating preserving as much of the ancient forest as possible. If therefore we want to preserve Bukit Timah Forest, we cannot permit further encroachment of any kind, and this forest is the only considerable area of primitive hill forest in the island. It contains many hundreds of species of native plants, many of which have been totally exterminated in the forests of the island, or soon will be exterminated when the urgently necessary building programs were implemented. This forest is unique. It is also irreplaceable. Richard Eric Holtham, Bukit Timah Forest for posterity. The Straits Times, 29th of March, 1950. But the forests which show how trees were made are going. They are vanishing nowhere faster than from the alluvial plains where the vestiges of the last creative phase of plant life that prepared the way for the modern world may survive. The modern mouth is the people's, and there's the new retaliation. Before machines, the forest is defenseless. Human progress is clearing it with gathering speed to plant crops of quick returns. Edred John Henry Corner, The Life of Plants, 1954. Out of his love of nature, Corner wanted to write a book for people to find beauty and inspiration in Singapore. Corner approached it from the angle of phytogeography. Even though the book included 950 different trees, it did not touch on the majority of the trees in the primitive forest. The subject of tree typology was too big even for Corner. The trees are mighty, and the botanist is puny as he stumbles among their roots and gropes for fallen fruits and flowers, he wrote. We have chosen trees as our subject because all the native richness of Malaya depends on the integrity of its forests. If a delight in trees and a respect for their majesty can be created even among a small body of persons, our country will never suffer the tragic domestication which many lands tamed have undergone. He wrote those words in the first edition preface for Wayside Trees of Malaya, based almost entirely on his observations. Corner wrote the book in simple speech since he despised technical jargon. For many who don't know, many of the botanic specimens included in Wayside Trees of Malaya are collected by his botanic monkeys. The idea came to him during his trip to northern Malaya around 1937. He spotted some monkeys collecting coconuts and had an epiphany to use them to collect specimens for the gardens, since he did not intend to cut down any tall trees. Neither was he good at climbing. When he returned to Singapore, he brought back 5 baroque monkeys, or macaques. He named all his monkeys in Malay. 2 of his favourites were called Putih, meaning white, from his pale fur, and Jumbul, meaning a crest from the dark patch on his head. During the training, he gave orders in Malay. One of his monkeys knew 24 Malay words: Mari for come, Lari for run, and Chari to signal search. Sometimes he'd point out fallen flowers or fruits, yelling, Ambil lagi! Would bring more, and Bukan naik lagi! Would get the monkey to climb up even more. As a reward, Mr. Corner often fed the monkeys lemonade. Once, Putih gathered samples from 24 sizable trees in a row before witnessing Corner open the lemonade flask. This irresistible beverage signals lunchtime, prodding Putih's sole cause of action, plunging down the tree for a sip. If a baroque sat on my shoulder, my hair was always subject to grooming. When I walked along with one, he would clutch hold of the hair at the back of my head, just as he had clutched long hair on the sides of his mother when a baby. The naughty Putih discovered in so doing that he could surreptitiously flick off my spectacles. Once in the forest, I spent a humiliating 20 minutes searching for them. A little hand working stealthily towards an ear alerted me. excerpts from Botanic Monkeys. Connor was proud of them and rewarded Jumbo and Pute as being the first apes to enter colonial service. As official members of colonial service, they were paid a wage of $127 million per year. Of course, payment was made in rice, bananas, and raw eggs. The monkeys brought him lots of joy and quite a lot of trouble at the same time. In 1942, he suffered a savage attack from one of the monkeys and it disabled his right arm. He decided to release them when the Japanese invaded Singapore. It was a blessing in disguise, as he was unable to join the Singapore Volunteer Force because of... During the Japanese occupation, Singapore was renamed Shonanto, supposedly due to respect for scientists. A few Japanese professors took administration roles in botanic gardens and protected some staff so they could remain in their positions. Connor was interned in the gardens and instructed to continue his horticultural work. I was fortunate to survive the war. However, many relatives and my parents died during those horrid years. The staff of the Botanic Gardens was not spared. Many were sent to work on Siam Burma Railway, including assistant curator John Charles Nauen, whom I never saw again. Connor's friendship with the Japanese had given him infamy as a traitor. He tolerated it to protect the Botanic Gardens and Raffles Museum's collection, records, and archives. When the Japanese left, the collections remained untouched. In 1945, after the war ended, Connor left for England. I didn't see him off, but he did send me a Christmas postcard that he had reunited with his family. My daughter, born just before the war, said Connor should have written more.
A nation adrift. After the war, Singapore was changing, and so was the river. Hokkien had taken over control of the river trade. That didn't mean Teochews were forgotten. With other modern transportation methods, like trucks and aeroplanes, the river's significance as a trade route began to decline. Large cargo ships could no longer navigate the shallow river, and port activities shifted to the other locations. One day, I saw a red-bearded white man taking pictures at the river. I was intrigued and said to him, "Are you taking photos of the coolies?" "Yes, I am. I love boats and the vibrant lives on them. My name is Carl Alexander Gibson Hill. I work at the Raffles Museum." We struck up a conversation and he was interested in my job at the Botanic Gardens. He became excited and asked me if I had any knowledge about birds. I told him about Wrightley Bird Essay and some other amateur research I had dabbled in over the years. I went on to share some observations I had made in the Botanic Gardens about local species such as the wren, the oriental white eye, and the pike wagtail. He then spoke about his life. Gibson Hill arrived in Singapore during the Japanese invasion and interned at Changi Prison as a prisoner of war. He used jail time to illustrate books such as Introduction of Malayan Birds. Claiming to be a non-professional ornithologist, Gibson Hill wrote articles and books, including a guide to the birds of the coast and a checklist of birds of Singapore Island. He proudly shared with me his amazing collection, including Robert Cushman Murphy logbook for Grace and Kate's magnet Loke Wan Tho's A Company of Birds. Loke's book was a lovely surprise. I couldn't imagine a busy businessman like him hiding in the wild and waiting for hours, even days. I liked how he wrote about the laughing thrush, the white-collar kingfisher, and the tailed drongo. I recall seeing them on the trip with Mr. Corner at the Bukit Timah Nature Reserve. However, most of the time, Gibson Hill spoke about boats. Before he set up the boat room at the Raffles Museum in 1952, Gibson Hill had already penned several articles about all the vessels frequently spotted in the Singapore waters. Malayan prowers and sampans, Indian dhows, and the Chinese tongkangs and tuakos. He asked me to pay attention to the shape of tuakos, squat and beamy, a toad-like version of the bumboat sampan. The flat bottom feature is specifically designed for the Singapore River. I occasionally followed him on his photography walks. Beside boats and the river scenes, he also documented the architectural landmarks around the river, including Empress Place, the General Post Office, and the New Bank of China building. By this time, my children were growing up. There were talks of Malayan independence. I wonder how it would affect the gardens and the river. I had another child, a son. My wife said he was like a monkey and said I should not have spent so much time with Corner's monkeys. 1963, changing of the guard. I was happy that Humphrey Morrison Burkill became director of the Botanic Gardens in 1957. He ran it until 1969. My career was coming full circle. I started my career under his father's leadership in this garden and would retire as he took up the same position. It was a tough position to be in during this time. Singapore was undergoing the transition from British colony to Malayanization, and he would be the fourth director in 8 years after Holtham. You could say Humphrey Morrison Burkill was born for the job. He was born in the Botanic Gardens at the director's house, which is now known as Burkill Hall, as a tribute to him and his father's shared directorship of the Botanic Gardens. This resonated deeply with me, as I shared a similar bond with the Burkills, just as the building did. The history of Burkill Hall leads back to Mr. Whampoa again. He was instrumental in the building of the director's house. Hoo Ah Kay Whampoa signed on the director's house builder's plans around 1867. The two-story hall was built for Lawrence Niven, the garden's first manager and landscape designer, and possibly recruited by Mr. Whampoa. I wonder if my father helped to deliver the signed construction plan. Somewhat in 1964, I read in the newspaper that the Nam Sang Hua Yuan, later known as the Bendemeer House, was demolished for redevelopment. This news saddened me deeply, as I fondly recall the water lilies that once graced its garden. Their absence left a void, compelling me to seek solace by visiting Swan Lake in the Botanic Gardens. The lake used to have a rare blue nymphaea in the pond. But when I visited, I saw all the water lilies had vanished. "It's gone!" a gardener working around Swan Lake shouted at me. He explained, "Just a few months ago, we caught 6 odd-looking turtles and countless aruan, a predatory fish in the pond. They ate all the water lilies. That's why they failed to bloom this year. We drained the water like how we once did to capture the crocodiles. We found the culprits." "Capture the crocodile?" I asked, sensing a mystery I had yet to hear of. The gardener laughed out. "Yes, about 70 years ago, a crocodile escaped into the pond and bit one of the gardeners. That's the last time the pond was drained. The older workers often recount how sad it was to clear all the flowers, especially the gorgeous giant water lilies. That was disappointing, but at least I learned something new about the garden's history. While the water lilies were gone, the orchids were blooming. Director Holtham's crowning achievement was the orchid enclosure. It was established within the Botanic Gardens a few years before Singapore's independence. I often brought my family to visit. Among all the vendor, Oncidium, Dendrobium, and the Pararachnis orchids, my favorite is the Oscidesa goldiana. Its delicate yellow petals sway like a graceful dancing lady in the breeze. In Teochew, we affectionately term it as Tiao Bu Hui. When Singapore became independent, the garden took a leading role in greening our nation. Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew announced a plan on 12 May 1967 that will transform Singapore into a beautiful garden city with flowers and trees, without waste, and as neat and orderly as possible. As a newly independent nation, numerous crucial matters demanded attention, and typically trees and gardens do not fall into that category. Nevertheless, Singapore was an exception to this rule. The Garden City policy greatly emphasized Singapore's parks and street planting. The Botanic Gardens flourished during this time. As a staff of Botanic Gardens, I witnessed researchers and experts contribute to the Garden City campaign. Dr. Chang Kiao Lan from the Herbarium, the first female doctor I knew, was in charge of the advisory for Mr. Lee's tree planting campaign. Coincidentally, her tutor in Cambridge was E.J.H. Corner. When the Garden City vision later expanded to the creation and maintenance of recreational parks and gardens, the Director's Hall was turned into the School of Horticulture in 1972. Its role was to equip public officers and students with theoretical and practical horticultural training. In February 1972, Queen Elizabeth visited the gardens and was captivated by the saffron spray orchid. It was renamed as the Dendrobium Elizabeth. 3 months later, I officially retired. I moved away from the Singapore River. At about the same time, when the government demolished Ellenborough Market, or Teochew Market, as it was better known, my daughter was growing up. There were more opportunities for women, and she managed to get a place in university to study engineering, of all things.
...1977, cleaning up the river and the greening of Singapore. Every time I return to Singapore after a few weeks absent and see the trees, palms, green grass, and free flowering shrubs as I drive along East Coast Parkway from the airport into the city, my spirits rise. Greening is the most cost-effective project I have launched. Mr. Lee wrote in his book, From Third World to First. Despite being retired, I stayed up to date on the tree planting campaign. I regret not having a chance to confirm with Dr. Chang how much Corner's Wayside Tree of Malaya inspired her while she was an advisor on the tree planting campaign. From my limited knowledge, choices of trees are made for particular reasons. Rain trees, acacia and angsana trees have massive crowns that offer a lot of shade. Sea apple and curtain creepers proliferate quickly, while yellow flame trees, dark pink frangipani and purple bougainvillea add color to the city. Last but not least, once forgotten fruit trees like binjai, kundang, and balonglong enhance the diversity. Through the 70s and 80s, while Singapore was still finding its way, the environment, cleaning, and planting were key themes in its development. Despite moving away from the river, I kept returning to it. A new hawker center was set up next to Boat Quay in 1973. It was convenient but filthy. The hawkers dumped everything into the river, which made the smell even worse. During low tide, one could see animal carcasses, human waste, food floating down the river. Horrifyingly, during high tide, kids still swam in the river. Chia Hien Kok, a teacher who grew up near Boat Quay, shared his memory. A distinct feature of our swimming style was that our heads were always above water because of the stench from the animal and human waste and the rubbish. One of our favorite antics was to catch a ride to the Elgin Bridge on the heavily loaded tongkangs and plied the river by climbing onto the rubber tires on its sides. It would be unfair to say that the colonial government didn't try to clean up the river. They had attempted to do so in 1905, 1919, and so on to improve the river aesthetically and hygienically while reducing congestion. However, the rivers had been sick for over a century. The ultimate solution was to widen and raise all the bridges to allow greater access to vessels. Besides planting trees, PM Lee Kuan Yew also launched a decade-long campaign starting in 1977 to clean up the Singapore River. The river was stretched. The river walls were rebuilt along its entire stretch, and a 6-kilometer promenade was constructed along both banks. A major component of the cleanup was relocation. About 4,000 squatters, hawkers, vegetable sellers whose daily waste flowed into the river had to be moved. Public housing was found for the squatters, while the street hawkers were persuaded to move to hawker centers. 800 bum boats were towed to Pasir Panjang. After that, the river slowly healed and its water was no longer so horrid. I still won't swim in it anymore, though. My son and daughter were both married and I became a grandparent. I enjoyed bringing my grandchildren to the river and the gardens and telling them stories. 1990, the journey continues. As the old Chinese proverb says, trees planted by the forefathers benefit their future generations. By 1984, the water in the Singapore River was clean enough that a mass swim was organized in mid-May. Some 400 brave participants took the plunge for the first ever swim across the Singapore River. Suppose you ever walk along the Singapore River today, you won't miss the sculpture next to Cavenna Bridge of kids plunged into the water. I acquired the sculpture prototype by chance. The artist had another sculpture at the Botanic Gardens called Chang Kuda, which captured another great scene of childhood play. He knows us well. As the groundwork for Singapore's new green skyline was laid, the state green policies and high-rise buildings make room for nature to flourish even vertically. No other project has brought richer rewards to the region. Our neighbors have tried to outgreen and outbloom each other. Green was positive competition that benefited everyone. It was good for morale, for tourism, and for investors. It was immensely better than we competed to be the greenest and cleanest in Asia, except from Lee Kuan Yew's form, Third World to First. To make my retirement life colorful, I conducted more research into the history of the gardens. I found out that famous philanthropist Jiang Hong Lim donated funds to the gardens to build an octagonal iron structure named Monkey House just a few years before I joined the Botanic Gardens. I look into William Farquhar and Alfred Russel Wallace's expeditions and their encounters with monkeys. I also spend time looking through Farquhar and Corner's botanic drawing collections. In good weather, I would following Gibson Hill's guide to visit other structures Coleman built, or bird watching in the park and gardens. In 1990, Coleman Bridge was the last bridge to be widened, and here marks the end of my story. I'm grateful that my life is intertwined with two sites that symbolize the growth of my country. If I wasn't by the Singapore River site, I wouldn't have been able to witness the bustling trade and commerce built on the sweat and blood coulees. If I hadn't in the Botanic Gardens, I wouldn't have known how plants and plantation economy laid the foundation of the Singapore trade. Most importantly, if not for the combination of both, I wouldn't have been as sensitive to the changes between and beyond. To preserve my memories and the city's evolution during my lifetime, I started collecting artworks and echo my memories. Through these pieces, I am to capture the city's evolution and transformation throughout the 20th century. As for the 21st century, I leave that task in your hands, my dear visitors, to carry forward.